All right, thank you. You may be seated. All right, thank you. You may be seated. Thank you so much. Go ahead and be seated. All right, please open your Bible to the book of 1 Samuel. Please open your Bible to the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 18. 1 Samuel, chapter 18, please. Thank you so much for being in chapel and being a student here this year. Without a lot of comments, because we're kind of rushed for time, let me ask all of the new students, whether you transferred in as a junior or your freshman or whatever, but this is your first semester to attend Hiles Anderson, would you stand right now without a lot of comments? Hang on. My wife and I would like to extend our welcome to you along with all the other welcomes you've received up to this point. And PA, if you'd turn my mic up just a little bit, please. We want to express our love to you. And so we have a small gift for you after chapel in the back of the auditorium. Listen carefully. If you're standing right now, there are a few copies of each of our books that we've written on some tables in the back. And so go by that table and pick out any one of those books. I'm not sure everybody will get the exact one you want, but what I happened to have in my storage closet this morning, we got them out. And so there's a few of each copy back there. So go by after chapel and pick out any one book you'd like to have as a gift from Mrs. Young and me. So you may be seated and welcome to Hiles Anderson. I want to remind you of a story in the Bible that is extremely familiar to all of us. We refer to it as David and Goliath. Most all of us are familiar with the story where Goliath was challenging the army of God. And a young man by the name of David rose to the challenge and was willing to fight that giant. And God used David. We often use the phrase David killed Goliath, and there's nothing wrong with that, but actually God killed Goliath. And God used a young lad by the name of David, probably in his teen years, maybe his latter teen years. God used David to kill Goliath. And that part of the story is extremely familiar to almost every one of us in the room this morning. But the rest of the story is not quite as familiar to some of us. After David was used by God to kill Goliath, then immediately he was promoted to be the general of the entire Israeli army. He had never been to boot camp. He had never been a buck private. He certainly had never been a corporal or a sergeant or a lieutenant or a captain. And now he's general of the army. Look, if you would, in chapter 18 at verse 5. Chapter 18, verse 5 says, "And David went out whithersoever Saul sent him and behaved himself wisely." Notice that phrase. "And behaved himself wisely, and Saul set him over the men of war," or made him the general of the army. In our day, it would be he became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. "And he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants." I believe every one of us would agree that it is a miracle of God that God chose to use a young lad. We often estimate that he was about 17 years of age. We would all agree that it is a miracle that God chose a 17-year-old boy to kill Goliath and save the Israeli army and the whole nation of Israel at that time. But I propose to you that it is just as much a miracle that 17-year-old boy who had never even been to boot camp is now promoted to be the general, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for the entire Israeli army. I also propose to you that not only are those two equal miracles, But the third miracle is it was accepted by all the people. Can you imagine if Trump got up one morning back when he was president and his morning tweet was, I chose a 17-year-old boy last night who has never been in the army to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Can you imagine what the media would do with that? But the Bible said everybody accepted it, and not only everybody, but Saul's other servants. You know what that's saying? The other captains and generals in the army, they accepted it. Can you imagine if the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the man, I don't know all the official titles, but the man that's in charge of our Army, the man that's in charge of our Air Force, the man that's in charge of our Navy, the man that's in charge of our Marines, if they came to work one morning and sitting in the desk where one of them was sitting yesterday as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, everyone looking right up here at me right now, real paying real close attention, can you imagine if sitting in that chair was a 17-year-old boy who had never been to boot camp, and he says, welcome to work, men. I appreciate you being here. I am the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And all four of those men stand to attention and salute and say, yes, sir. And not just do it out of duty, but accept it. I propose to you that is as big of a miracle as it was that God used a 17-year-old boy to kill Goliath. And the fourth miracle that to me is as much a miracle and maybe more so than all three of the others is that that 17-year-old boy behaved himself wisely. He handled it. If a 17-year-old kid who had never been to boot camp suddenly becomes the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he has just been handed on a silver platter all the ingredients that he needs to self-destruct. But David didn't. He behaved himself wisely. When I was 21 years of age and still a student here in the college, and I was placed in charge of the entire BC&D bus ministry of the 155 bus routes at the time, I did not behave myself wisely in all manners. I made some horrific mistakes when I first began. Some of the staff members that have been here for years, you remember the day we had the Break the Record Sunday on the BC&D buses after I'd been the bus director for about 2 years, and our goal was to have 12,000, and that day we had 12,996. And we had a big giant junior church service down in the Hammond Civic Center with 5,525 third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade boys and girls all in that Hammond Civic Center. And by the way, when the service ended, the building was still standing. But 454 boys and girls got saved that day, but not one single bus made it back to the evening service that night. Not one. The first one, the service started at 7 o'clock. The first one got back at 8:15. The first bus. The last bus got back at 10:30 that night. Not the night bus, the morning bus. The last one got back at 10:30 that night. There were whole sections of the auditorium that were completely empty. Not one single person sitting in them that night. And believe you me, it was thoroughly explained to me for the next week or so all the mistakes I had made in having that big day. I made some horrific mistakes, but David didn't. David behaved himself wisely. Now, if you would, look at verse 6. And it came to pass, as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day forward. Would you look at me for a moment? David and Saul come home from the battle. Saul's leading the victory parade. David's off to his right, one half step behind. That's official military protocol. And the ladies from all the cities have come out to welcome them home from the battle. And they're lined up on both sides of the street. And they're singing a folk song that they've written in honor of this battle. And verse 1 says, Saul has slain his thousands. And Saul liked verse 1. But then the ladies on the other side of the street, they answer back with verse 2. And verse 2 says, and David his tens of thousands. And Saul didn't like verse 2. And he became jealous. All right, well, if you would, look with me right quick at verse 10. And it came to pass on the morrow that the evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of the house, and David played with his hand, or played his harp with his hand, as at other times, and there was a javelin, or we might call it a spear, in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the javelin, or the spear, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall with it, and David avoided out of his presence twice. And Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, with David, and was departed from Saul. Therefore, notice this phrase. Therefore, verse 13, Saul removed him from him. Now, let me explain carefully what that's saying. It reads like this. Therefore, Saul removed David from Saul. And made him, David, his captain over 1,000, no longer general of the entire army, now only a captain over 1,000 men in some remote place out of Saul's presence. And he went out and came in before the people. Now look at verse 14. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways. And the Lord was with him. Would you look at me for a moment? If you think David had been given all the ingredients he needed to self-destruct at the age of 17 when he was put in charge of the entire Israeli army, more so than that, now he has been given not only all the ingredients he needed, but the instructions on how to do it. Now he has been demoted from being the general of the army to being a captain over 1,000 men in some remote area when he did absolutely nothing wrong. But the Bible said he behaved himself wisely, not just wisely, but wisely in all his ways. All right, now let's continue reading. Would you look, please, in verse 15. Verse 15 says, wherefore, when Saul saw that he, David, behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. Would you look at me for a moment? It's bad enough that he got promoted to be the general, but he behaved himself wisely. Then it's worse than that he got demoted when he did nothing wrong, but his boss was jealous of him, and he behaved himself wisely in all his ways. But now, worse than both of those, he's caught in the middle. He's caught in the middle between his boss that hates him and is literally trying to kill him and all the people that loved him. You know how to behave when you're among friends. You let your hair down. You relax. You kind of say what you want to. You know how to behave when you're among all enemies. You put your guard up. You're very careful about what you say. You watch your P's and Q's. But when you get caught in the middle between your enemy that hates you and your friends that love you, and some of them love each other, and now you're caught in the middle, David behaved himself very wisely. You see what's happening here? As the situation becomes more and more complicated, David is rising to the occasion. All right, let's continue reading. Would you look, please, in verse 17? And Saul said to David, behold, my elder daughter Merab, her will I give thee to wife. Only be thou valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. Would you look at me just for a second? Doesn't that sound pious? Doesn't that sound like a righteous, holy cause? Hey, David, if you'll be valiant and fight the Lord's battles, I'll give you my daughter and let you marry her. But let's see what else Saul said. Look at verse 17 again. And Saul said to David, behold, my elder daughter Merab, her will I give thee to wife. Only be thou valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul said, let not mine hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him. You know what Saul's saying is? He said, I tried twice to kill the kid and I can't do it. So I'll let the enemy kill him. All right, now skip down to verse 28, if you would, please. Verse 28 says, and Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's Michal, Saul's daughter, Saul's other daughter, loved him, loved David. Verse 29. And Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and Saul became David's enemy continually. Notice that phrase. We'll come back to it in a moment. Then the princes of the Philistines went forth, or the leaders of the Philistine army came back out to do battle. That's what it's saying. And it came to pass, after they went forth, after the Philistine army came out, that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was much set by. Would you look at me just for a second? It's bad enough when you get promoted to be the general of the army at 17. It's worse than that when you get demoted when you haven't done anything wrong. It's worse than that when you get caught in the middle between those who love you and those who hate you, and some of them love each other. But worse than all of that put together, now David's put in a situation where he has to choose his enemy. Is Saul my enemy? The man that God placed in authority above me? Even though Saul is living a wicked life at this time and Saul is literally trying to murder David, is Saul my enemy, or are the Philistines my enemy? And David chose the right enemy. You remember when Paul said, I have fought a good fight? Paul didn't mean I'm good at fighting. He meant I chose the right fight to fight. Paul, okay, you ever heard the phrase, choose your battles? Well, that's what David did here. The Bible said that Saul became David's enemy continually. But if you read the rest of the story, and I know most of you have, you find that David had two different occasions when he had the opportunity to kill Saul. And in my opinion, if he had done so, he could have gone to court and gotten off on self-defense. But he didn't become Saul's enemy. He chose the Philistines to be his enemy. What's happening here? The same thing that's happening to David is the exact same thing that's going to happen to you. And it usually begins about this phase in your life. Now, for some of you, you got a head start on us. You came from a situation that created lots of complications in your life. But for most of us, we lived a somewhat normal life up until about this time in our life. And all of a sudden, we stepped out the door one day and looked back, and Mom had locked the door. In fact, Mom and Dad remodeled your bedroom and made another room out of it the moment you left to go to college. It's exactly what happened to me in my house. The first time I went home for Christmas after I came to college, my bedroom had been remodeled into a different room. And all of a sudden, life begins to become more and more complicated. One of the best things Brother Hiles ever taught me is I remember one day when he and I were traveling together, which we did often the last 12 years of his life. I remember him saying to me, Ray, life becomes more and more complicated as you go along. You know, every one of us subconsciously are waiting and hoping for that wonderful moment that we finally arrive at that utopia and wow, everything's wonderful and everything's beautiful and I don't have any more problems. And that's going to happen to you. It's called the millennium. But between now and then, let a 68-year-old man who's been in the ministry 53 years testify to you, life becomes more and more complicated as it goes along. And here's what you and I can do. We can use those complications as a pretty good excuse on why we failed. Or you can use those complications as the ingredients you need to mature and grow and become a better person. It's up to you. It's your choice. But what I want to do this morning, a 68-year-old man who's been in the ministry 53 years, I want to give you a little bit of a head start. I'm going to give you nine things. I've got about 10 minutes. I'm going to give them to you quickly. I'm going to give you nine things that you can do, nine ingredients you can use to help you use life to mature instead of letting life become your excuse why you are not able to succeed. Number one, don't say anything immediately. Whatever comes your way, whether it's good or bad, don't say anything immediately. The Bible says, let every man be swift to hear, but slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. And that leads me to number two. I said, number one, don't say anything immediately. Number two, don't respond while you're angry. Remember what David said? David said, O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. Jeremiah said something similar. He said, O Lord, correct me, but with judgment, not in thine anger, lest thou bring me to nothing. Hey, if David and Jeremiah both felt like they would get a better deal, if God would, and I know this may sound a little sacrilegious, but forgive me. If David and Jeremiah both felt like they'd get a better shake, if God would calm down first before he corrected them, don't you think you and I would treat each other better if we had calmed down first before we respond? And that leads me to number three, act, don't react. Act, don't react. What do I mean? I mean, don't make your decisions based on how others treat you. Make your decisions based on who you are. Don't allow someone else to take control of your behavior. A few years ago, a man cussed me out for an hour and 15 minutes. And when I say cussed me out, I don't mean he said, you're a meanie. I mean he cussed me out for an hour and 15 minutes in front of some other people. And for an hour, a man that was supposed to be a Christian. A man, and for an hour and 15 minutes, I sat there and said nothing. But the hour and 15 minutes, I thought, I know what you want. You want me to come down there on your level and cuss it out with you, but I don't live down there. Act, don't react. Number four, never allow this. Number three leads me to number four. Number four, never allow an evil person, a simple person, an angry person to drag you down to their level. You know, the Bible speaks about a strange woman, speaks of a whorish woman, an evil woman, a simple woman, a lustful woman. Fellas, can I remind you of something? If a sinful, lustful, evil, simple woman wants you because of what you are, if she gets you, you will no longer be what she wanted. What am I saying? Don't criticize a critic. Don't slander a slanderer. Don't answer an open letter with an, oh, well, nowadays, don't answer a textbook, a text with a text or a Facebook post with a Facebook post. Don't try to match wit for wit. Don't try to match insult for insult. Hey, do you know, anytime you get in a fight with a skunk, even if you win, you're going to come out stinking. That leads me to number five. Never become your enemy's enemy. Now, I don't mean you shouldn't be willing to defend your nation. I don't mean you shouldn't be willing to defend your family. But when you're over here trying to accomplish something worthwhile and somebody over there throws a rock at you and you go spend all of your time picking up rocks so that you can throw rocks back at him, what you were doing is no longer getting done. Hey, suppose you're running a race and somebody in the stands yells out, number six is a bomb, and you're number six. And you hear him. So you divert off the track, you run up in the stands, you grab the guy, you beat him to a pulp, you throw him down on the ground, and you proved that you were a bigger man than he was. And you look back and the race is over and you lost. Don't become your enemy. If someone's trying to destroy you, don't waste your time. Hey, listen, can a 68-year-old man that's been in the ministry 53 years tell you something that you would listen to? Would you please listen? The girls in the back there are talking. Would you please listen? He will self-destruct much quicker than you could have ever destroyed him if you tried to. Number six. Never make any change of direction decisions without mature counsel. If you're headed somewhere and you feel like this is where the Lord wants me to go, and now you're considering the possibility of making some alteration in that path, you ought to get mature counsel before you do so. Someone older than you. Someone more experienced than you. Someone who's been saved longer than you. Someone who's been involved in the area of your decision longer than you've been involved in it. Someone that's been doing what you're doing longer than you've been doing it. Someone who has often counseled others. Someone who has counseled others through this type decision. Someone who has been succeeding in life on a long-term basis, or someone who is succeeding with his own family. And by the way, the more of those ingredients that your counselor has, the better chance you are of getting good counsel. I'm not saying that just because somebody's older than you, that he is necessarily the one to give you counsel in this particular area. Okay, so he's older than you, but he's on his fifth marriage and he's got four kids and three of them are in prison and the other one won't speak to him. He might not be the right one to get family counsel from. He might not be the one to go to as your marital counselor. He may be a great mechanic. You might go to him and get a lot of advice about how to fix a car. I'm saying the more of those ingredients that the counselor has, the better chances are you are of getting good counsel. Number seven, never make a life-altering decision. Now, let me say this before I get to number seven. Some messages we preach here in chapel, they're to help you get through tonight and make it back to chapel tomorrow. That's the purpose of the message. This message is not intended to transform your life in the next 30 minutes, but it's intended to help you survive life on the long-term basis. So I'm going to give you a little bit of advice here that for most of you it doesn't apply yet, but it will. My next point is this, number seven, never make a life-altering decision without your spouse's enthusiastic endorsement. Never make a life-altering decision without your spouse's enthusiastic endorsement. Fellas, would you look at me for a minute? Every fellow in the room, please look right up here real quick. I remember being your age. I remember going through the dating process. I remember getting married. I remember those first few years of marriage. I remember all the fears of, am I going to be a wimp? Am I going to be henpecked? Am I going to be led around by the nose? Am I ever going to be a real man? Will I someday get a man card? I remember all those thoughts. But can I tell you something? From a 68-year-old man who's been in the ministry 53 years, I have never seen one situation, one, not one in 53 years have I seen some man just know for sure this is God's will for my life, but my rebellious wife won't come along and he forces her into it and it turned out good. Not one time. Hey, if you can't even lead your wife, that loves you, the one person on the face of this earth that wants you to succeed more than anybody else in this world wants you to, if you can't even convince her it's God's will, how are you going to convince anybody else it's God's will for them to come and do it with you? You might ought to do what the Bible says. You might ought to get your house in order first and then go help everybody else get their house in order. Number eight. Never make a major decision based only on money or only on a position or only on a title or only on popularity or comfort or anger or retaliation. I remember when Dr. Evans wanted to retire, The pastor came and asked me if I would like to be the president. I was executive vice president at the time. And I said, no, thank you. I have no desire to be the president. I was just doing that part-time to help Dr. Evans out while he was ill. And if he's going to retire and you're going to get a new president, I'll go back down to the church and just work full-time at the church where I started instead of working in both areas. 9 months later, he came back to me and he said, Ray, I've been trying for the last 9 months to find a new president. I haven't found one yet. Would you at least pray about the possibility of becoming president, because that's what I need you to do? And I said, I don't need to pray about it. And he looked at me with a puzzled look in his face, and I said, if you need me to be the president, that's a totally different question than you asked me 9 months ago if I wanted to be. If you need me to be, I don't need to pray about it. Sure, I'll be glad to be the president. Don't make your decisions just on a title or a position. Make your decisions based on a worthy cause. And that leads me to number 9. Make all your decisions based on clear biblical principles and a worthy cause. We may not transform anybody's life in chapel today, but we could salvage many people's life and ministry if you'll listen to what I told you today. Thank you.